This is Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide. This week, we talk with Dakota author and activist Wazia Thawin. We have music by Filthy Politicians and Flesh for Lulu. This is Rage, building a community of resistance one podcast at a time. Hello and welcome to the 16th edition of Rage, Radio Against Global Ecocide, coming to you from occupied Amiskwatsee, Biscayan. I am your host, Seymour Life. And a special hello to all the true anti-civ persons out there working to bring it down. Roll on, roll on. First off, a terrible act of cowardice and abuse was committed against a friend of mine and guest on this show, Lierre Keith. Some overprivileged, holier-than-thou, militant vegan fuckers attacked Lierre by pieing her with cayenne-laced cream pies. Most likely three men, attacked Lierre, who suffers from a degenerative bone disease, from behind with cayenne-laced pies, specifically designed in Nazi-like fashion to kill free speech. Other vegans have had the gall to justify this and criticizing Lierre for calling the police. When a woman is being attacked by men with the intent to maim, she has every right to call the police. A woman being attacked by men has every right to call the police. Nothing changes that. This was an assault on a woman by men, and it is unforgivable in its cowardice and oppressive nature. We in the community also need to be diligent in protecting each other from such acts of cowardice. Obviously, some of the organizers were aware this was going to happen. Lierre, I want you to know that we at Rage stand with you and support you in every way we can. This is a reminder why we need to stand together and support each other. It is also a reminder that the longer we wait to bring the system down, the longer we have to put up with this shit. It is time to return the land to indigenous peoples. It is time to return the buffalo to the prairie. It is time to stop the Wendigo and their disease. And now for our guest tonight. Wazia Thawin is a Dakota activist, author, and feminist. She also works as the Indigenous Peoples Research Chair and Associate Professor in the Indigenous Governance Program at the University of Victoria. Wazia Thawin, welcome to the show. How would you describe yourself?
Well, the best way I think that I can describe myself is to tell you who I am in Dakota. The way that I would do that is I will tell you Damakota, Wahbetuan Hemacha, Pejihutazizi Kap Imakoche Hechia Tahan Wahie, Waziatui Emakiapie. And what I just said to you was Damakota, I am Dakota. And more specifically, I am Wahbetuan Dakota, and in English, that might be translated as Dwellers Among the Leaves, and it's one of the seven council fires of the Dakota Nation. And I told you that I come from the place where they dig for yellow medicine, and in English, that place is known as the Upper Sioux Reservation, and it's located in southwestern Minnesota. And lastly, I told you that they call me Wazia Thawin in Dakota, and in English, that can be translated as Woman of the North. And I guess in addition to that, I would also say in English that I consider myself a teacher, a writer, and an activist.
So how did you get involved in the Indigenous Governance Program at U of Victoria?
Well, you know, I had my educational background is in history, and I had spent about 7 years teaching in the history department at Arizona State University and hated my experience so much there that I left the academy thinking I would probably never go back. And it was really when the position opened up, the Indigenous Peoples Research Chair's position in the Indigenous Governance Program at UVic, became available and I applied, I realized that it was the only position in North America that I had any interest in taking, the only academic. So I applied hoping that I would get it, and fortunately I did, and it's been a very good move for me.
Maybe describe a little bit what goes on there, just because it is for Indigenous governments, but how's that sort of defined, and what are some of the programs within that?
Well, the Indigenous Governance Program is a graduate program, so we primarily work with master's students and then also work with PhD students by special arrangement. And my other two colleagues in the program are both political scientists, so I think it's been heavily focused in previous years on the political science base. With my contributions, I really focus on the recovery of traditional knowledge. I focus on language and oral traditions specifically. I'm interested in Indigenous women's resistance. So those are some of the things that I bring to the table with the program.
My wife is Indigenous, and she took the Native Studies program here. And it was funny, you were just talking about traditional knowledge. And she called them, it must have been 6 or 7 months ago, asking, do they know people that do traditional knowledge training courses or classes? Because she wanted to set that up for some people that were asking about it, and she wanted to do some herself. And they basically said, no, we do everything purely academic. So I think that's quite interesting.
Yeah, very interesting.
To ask you about the Crow Creek land, the unlawful auctioning of Crow Creek land, can you set that up? Just to talk a little bit about it, and then maybe also give the update on that, a process that is ongoing, but it highlights a lot of what's ongoing on a regular basis that people are not really aware of.
Absolutely. I think it still takes me by surprise when things like this happen. You know, early December, I found out that the IRS had claimed 7,000 acres of land in South Dakota belonging to the Crow Creek Nation, and they claimed the land based on alleged employee back taxes owed by Crow Creek to the IRS. And this is really something I'd never heard of before, and I knew there were a lot of issues around it. But I was alerted to the issue primarily because the tribal chairman out there, Brandon Sazu, had made a declaration that he was going to make a stand on that land, that they would not take that land, or if they did, it would be over his dead body, that he was committing himself to staking himself out on that piece of land. And I was so inspired by that, I think, that I went out to visit Brandon and spent some time out there and did some writing, tried to rally support in support of his actions, and continued to engage discussions with people about the legality of this. And, you know, really what it comes down to in a nutshell is that even according to the U.S. Constitution, in both Article 1 and the 14th Amendment, it says specifically, Indians not taxed. And so Indigenous attorneys and people who've looked into this really question the legality of the right of the IRS, no matter how much might be owed in back taxes, for them to actually take the land. So in December, when the IRS claimed the land, they then put the land on the auction block and sold it to a white rancher in South Dakota. And I would say that not coincidentally, the land that was claimed by the IRS and auctioned off is also land that has world-class sites for wind power energy development.
Right.
And so what we know, for example, under the Obama administration right now is that he's called for a review of the western states and their potential for alternative energy development. And we also know that there's a kind of a new gold rush, I would say, going on in the western United States because everyone is searching for these alternative sources. So Crow Creek has prime land, and the other factor, I think, in them selecting Crow Creek or putting pressure on Crow Creek like this is that Crow Creek also has the poorest county in the United States. Much of the reservation is located within that county. And so it was really about targeting a group that I think the government believed wouldn't fight back.
Right.
Fortunately, Brandon Sazu's stake out on the land drew a lot of attention, not just national attention in the United States, but international attention from around the world. And so the IRS, which previously had refused to negotiate on this tax bill with Crow Creek, suddenly agreed that they would negotiate. And we just found out several days ago, it was just published in the Argus Leader newspaper on March 1st, that the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe has settled its tax debt with the Internal Revenue Service and lined up a loan that will enable it to buy back the 11 square miles of land the IRS sold at auction in December. So what happened is that one of the other Dakota communities, a very wealthy community in Minnesota, the Shakopee Bittawakuntung Sioux Tribe, stepped in and negotiated with the IRS. They are allowing the Crow Creek people to take a loan from Shakopee to pay off the debt to the IRS, essentially. But it sounds like the debt or the payment is actually going to be going to the white rancher who bought the land for that payment, and that the IRS will forgive the remainder because there was a discrepancy of about $500,000 or several hundred thousand dollars. So it's been resolved now, I would say, in that Crow Creek is not going to lose the land, but it doesn't address the issue of whether or not the IRS actually ever had the authority to claim the land and auction it off in the first place. And one of the attorneys, Dakota attorneys and law professors, who wrote on this topic, her name is Angelique Eaglewoman, wrote in an article that for the Crow Creek Sioux Tribe, their nationhood status preempts any exercise of federal taxing authority. And the invasion by the IRS to seize tribal land should be viewed as a hostile takeover by a foreign nation. And she concludes her article by saying, this action by the United States should signal to every tribal nation that our homelands are under attack. And I think that this is a really important point because we're all taught to believe that things are getting progressively better or they're at least getting more just for indigenous populations in the United States. And in fact, the reality is that nothing has, or very little has changed. Nothing is improving. And in fact, even under the Obama administration, you had what amounted to the largest land grab of Dakota territory since the 19th century.
Yeah. I mean, it still boggles my mind, but I did see a bit on the fact that they got a loan to get their land back, and I'm still saying, well, they shouldn't have been able to tax in the first place. That's
right.
That was what was going through my mind. It's like they shouldn't have been gone to that level.
Exactly. And the concession on the part of Crow Creek in this process was that the IRS would forgive the remainder of their debt if they agreed to dismiss the lawsuit that Crow Creek was filing against them. And
right.
So this was an attempt by the Justice Department to scramble to try to make this go away because they certainly didn't want it even in the court system.
And that's when I first saw it, that's the first thing I said is that to myself. And I was asking my wife the same thing. I said, they can't tax, right? I mean, it's just, how is this possible? It made no sense.
Right. And part of it is that I think many indigenous peoples here in the States have become so complacent in terms of accepting this taxation in the first place and being really afraid to fight it, primarily because the United States continues to have this never-ending supply of attorneys that can keep things tied up in courts for many years or even decades.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exhausting, it's draining, and it's too hard to fight, or it seems too big to fight. And so for the most part, populations here go along with it because the alternative is tied up in court for years, pay millions of dollars, and then run the risk of losing anyway with the Supreme Court.
Because that reminds me, too, when you're talking about that, I don't know if you were familiar with a fellow by the name of Tom Flanagan.
Yes.
Yes. Anyway, and he seems to be in the process of writing a book or a thesis or a concept where really he's trying to bring in the concept of being able to sell private land within the reserves themselves within Canada so that people could, you know, if they wanted to. And this seems more of that same process of trying to steal land, but through the back door in a way.
Right. Well, it sounds very much like the Allotment Act in the United States, 19th century. And in that process, when individual allotments were made to heads of household and they then had the option to sell or were pressured into selling or tricked or bribed or killed or, you know, any means were necessary to get a hold of the land.
Right.
And indigenous populations here lost 2 out of every 3 acres as a consequence.
Wow. You wrote a call to action for the Crow Creek. Within that, you also talked about more about the history of the Dakota people. And I wonder if you could share more of that with us as well.
Right. You know, it's, I would like to say that our history is unique because it's so terrible, really. It's just filled with one atrocity after another. But unfortunately, it's not. I think it really is maybe not entirely typical, but definitely not entirely unique either of the experience of indigenous peoples really across the board. So, you know, like other populations, we had our lands invaded, and we initially attempt to work peacefully with the invaders. We negotiated treaties. Treaties were violated. We had constant encroachment on our lands, and when we had finally reached our limit, couldn't take any more, some of our people went to war in 1862. And, you know, the war was short-lived. We were outgunned and outnumbered. But the consequences of the war make it clear that the war, Dakota people were pushed to war precisely so that the United States government and its citizens would be able to take our lands and resources and justify it in their own minds or justify it for, I don't know, to themselves or to the citizens, whoever they needed to justify it to. So at the conclusion of the war, 300 of our Dakota men, over 300, were sentenced to execution by hanging. Men and women, the condemned men and women and children, were forcibly removed to concentration camps in other parts of the state. So the women and children were placed in a concentration camp at Fort Snelling in St. Paul, Minnesota. The men were brought to Mankato, and one of the most spectacular events of that period was on December 26, 1862, when 38 Dakota warriors were hanged by the neck until dead in what remains the largest mass simultaneous hanging by one gallows in world history.
Wow.
And that was ordered by President Abraham Lincoln. The remaining men were kept confined in Minnesota that winter and then were sent in the spring to Davenport, Iowa, where they were imprisoned for another 3 years. A third of the population was killed as a consequence of that imprisonment. The women and children were sent on boats that went down the Mississippi River and then up the Missouri and were brought to Crow Creek in South Dakota. Conditions there were just horrendous. They talk about gravesides littering the hillsides within the first few months, within the first several months of being there, predominantly children dying because of the circumstances. And even that wasn't enough. Our treaties were unilaterally abrogated by the United States government. Punitive expeditions were sent into Dakota territory to hunt down any Dakota who fled. And bounties were placed on the scalps of our people. So beginning in the summer of 1863, they started at $25, eventually reached $200, which in 1862 was enough to buy a 160-acre homestead. So those bounties were initiated, and Dakota people were essentially completely dispossessed of our Minnesota homeland. And today, years later, decades later, small populations of Dakota people began to trickle back, and in the 20th century, there were 4 small communities were established. And so, for example, my community of Upper Sioux is located right along the Minnesota River in the southwestern part of the state, and our people started coming back here in the late 1880s, and our reservation was officially recognized in the 1930s, but we're a tiny community. All of the communities in Minnesota today are very small, and we, you know, roughly have about 0.01% of our original land base, and the vast majority of our people continue to live in exile. So we're a population that was we had wars, we had policies of genocide and ethnic cleansing perpetrated against us, and our lands were stolen, our treaties not just violated. And I think this is where the Dakota experience is a little bit different from other indigenous nations, and that we're one of the few nations that had our treaties unilaterally abrogated by the United States government, which should mean that everything should go back to a pre-treaty status. But of course, that's not what happened. The United States government claimed the land and then didn't pay everything they were supposed to pay for the land.
Mm. Well, it leaves you speechless when you hear that kind of stuff that happens all through two people that, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's horrendous.
It really is.
Appalling.
Yeah, and very much so. I think one of the things that, Derek mentions this, but it was one of the things that people don't know, I think, a lot of people don't know, is that Hitler actually designed his concentration system very much on what he learned from how indigenous peoples were treated in the United States.
Absolutely. He admired the efficiency.
Oh, God. Yeah. I didn't realize that until I watched Broken Rainbow, which a documentary on the Navajo people and how they were treated and pushed off their land.
Right, yeah, very similar experience.
Because you work in both countries, and this is one of the, as a myth, is that indigenous peoples were treated much better in Canada than in the U.S. I really sort of want to have that examined and ask you, is that really true from your perspective? And then also, what are the differences and what are the similarities that, as you understand them?
Right. You know, I mean, that's a really important question because I think it is a pervasive myth, and I hear people in the States say that all the time. I don't usually hear people in Canada say that, or at least not Indigenous populations in Canada say that, because I think that they're aware of the reality or the extent of the oppression and the crimes against humanity that have been perpetrated and continue to be perpetrated. So, you know, I absolutely believe that that's a myth, and I continue to learn more. I mean, obviously, you know, my area of, I have more knowledge about what has happened in the United States and what continues to happen here. But I'm learning more and more about Canadian history and Canadian conditions today all the time. So, you know, I would say that there's a lot more similar than there is different, that we all share the experience of colonization, and which is in itself a very, very violent process, and dispossession from our lands. Obviously, the residential school and boarding school experiences are almost identical, except that the worst cases, I think, were continued in Canada later than they were in the United States. And I have to qualify that some, too, because I know even into the 1980s, that there were still horrendous reports coming out of places like the Phoenix Indian School. So, you know, we have to be careful when we make those comparisons that we don't forget, because even one example of crime against humanity can't be forgotten or can't be overlooked. So one of the things that strikes me now when I, especially as I'm working with graduate students who are pursuing different topics, are where some of the things that surprise me really have to do with children and the way that children are continue to be taken out of their homes. Mm-hmm. And one of my graduate students right now, her name is Molly Wickham, and she's with Wet'suwet'en from BC, and she's working with youth in custody on different projects, but is very much interested in how Indigenous families have been disconnected, separated from one another. And she cites the work of Christine Morris, who reported that there are three times more children in foster homes today in Canada than children in residential schools, even at the height of the residential school era.
Wow.
And when you think about that, it's astounding, really. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're talking about the 21st century. We're talking about a time when conditions are supposed to be improving. And you think about the number of Indigenous children who are taken out of their families and communities, and that's appalling. In the United States, we had the Indian Child Welfare Act, which prevented children after 1978 from moving into white homes at the rate that they were before. It's not to say that that doesn't happen anymore, but now social welfare workers they have to try to place children in Indigenous homes preferably Indigenous family, extended family homes, or someone in the community. And if not, then they may be placed in white homes, but they have to initially make that effort. And it doesn't seem to work that way in Canada. And it's, so that's one of the glaring differences that I see today. But I definitely see more similarities than I do anything else.
I'm glad you mentioned that about the children, because last year or a year before, I remember a woman, she used to be, or she's part of the head group of Métis, and she actually said outright that the foster home, the foster care system is, in Alberta, she was talking specifically about Alberta, is become the new residential school system. Like, wow. She came right out and said it. It's the new one. And it's a major issue, and the Alberta government really has set it up that you can't they've made it very hard for the press to talk about it. I mean, to be fair to the press, in some ways they've made it so that you can't use the child's name, you can't use the parent's name, and you can't use the foster parent's name.
Wow.
So how do you talk about the issue at all? So they've really tried to make it very hard to talk about it, but it is something that's being from a number of the Indigenous community groups are saying that this is quite serious.
Well, it attacks the, families are the core. There's absolutely no way that our populations can continue or can begin to recover, heal, or I guess live any sense of indigeneity if our children are taken away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't do it. It's not going to happen. It just adds to the long list of assaults that need to be remedied or need to be rectified.
Right, exactly. My wife's grandmother and her mother both went through the residential school system, and it's definitely left its mark.
Yeah, it's absolutely devastating. And yeah. I think that I think really just now we're starting to realize the magnitude of the harm perpetrated as a consequence of residential schools and boarding schools. I mean, we know about deaths, we know about sexual abuse, about physical abuse, but I think the real, I think that there are a lot of spiritual, psychological, and other kinds of harms that we still are just now starting to come to terms with.
So what do you, I remember hearing you talk on, I'm trying to remember the website name was resistanceisfertile.ca.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and...
up there in Guelph.
Yeah, and I've actually been trying to find that website since, and I haven't been able to find that because I wanted to listen to some of what you said before asking you questions, so I could only go by what I remembered you had said. And one of the topics you were talking about was decolonization. And I wonder if you can talk about that in terms of how you see that for Indigenous peoples, and then how do you see that for non-Indigenous peoples?
Right. Okay. So several years ago, Michael Yellowberg, a colleague of mine, we put together a book called A Decolonization Handbook, or it's for Indigenous eyes only, A Decolonization Handbook. And when we were working on that volume, we crafted a definition of decolonization, and I'll go ahead and give that to you and then maybe talk about it from there.
Okay.
What we said is that decolonization is the intelligent, calculated, and active resistance to the forces of colonialism that perpetuate the subjugation and or exploitation of our minds, bodies, and lands. And it's engaged for the ultimate purpose of overturning the colonial structure and realizing Indigenous liberation. And when we were crafting that definition, obviously we had Indigenous peoples in mind, that this is how we think it's useful to talk about decolonization among Indigenous populations. And, one of the points I want to make about that, because I think decolonization is a term that we hear thrown around a lot, and I think that many people envision kind of tweaking the existing systems or institutions, kind of decolonizing them or indigenizing things and then calling that decolonization. And we were very clear when we were crafting that definition that we don't mean just tweaking the existing system and institutions, that what we're talking about is overturning all of those systems and institutions that continue to oppress us. And, you know, that's pretty much every system and institution that we encounter in our daily lives. And ultimately, if it's carried to its farthest extent, means the dismantling of the Canadian state, the dismantling of the United States of America. And when I say that, I was like, I'm not kidding. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's what we mean. So for us, I mean, I think that there are a couple of components to decolonization, central components. And, you know, the first is about how do we begin to undo the effects of colonization on our own lives. And so it means taking an inventory of how we've been affected by colonization, and to recover the ways of being that I think our peoples, that allowed our peoples to survive so well prior to colonization. And so that's one aspect. The other aspect obviously has to be about how do you begin to overturn those systems and institutions. You know, what does that require? And that is a different level of action, and I think requires different kinds of actions. I would say for non-Indigenous populations that really decolonization is very similar in many ways, and that it is going to, but I think more of the emphasis has to be on overturning the systems and institutions first, in part because there isn't necessarily in the memory of settler populations today this alternative way of being. Right. And I think that much of the instruction, perhaps, on how to live on this land in a good way is going to have to come under the direction or with the help or with through the teachings of Indigenous populations. But I think, you know, all of us right now, I think the ongoing harms, especially to the land and to the environment, are so obscene that there is a sense of urgency now about focusing on how to bring down the corporations, the governments, the systems that allow this harm to continue. I mean, you know, there really is. We need to do it more quickly, I think, than yeah. even I had anticipated yeah. 5 years ago when we created those definitions.
Yeah, it does seem to be ramping up the other way quite a bit, and it does seem to bring home. I mean. We'll get to the tar sands a little later, but it's just seeing so much stuff happening lately. I don't know if you know Liere Keith, but I'm just saying to her, you know, I feel such an urgency about this right now. It's crazy. I was at a talk with four Indigenous women. One of them was from New Zealand, Maori from New Zealand, and the talk really sort of pretty much started with the whole issue of blood quantum, because there was one woman there. She said that she was born on the Saddle Lake Reserve, or actually I think her father was, and she left that and went and lived on a Métis settlement. She went there, and then she identified more with the Métis than she did with her Cree family, wanted to stay there, but she wasn't allowed to because she was Cree. So she went back to the Saddle Lake Reserve, but then the Saddle Lake Reserve said, because she had left for a certain period, I mean, it was the politics of it was just crazy. And a lot of it boiled down to the issue of how much blood quantum she had of within her lineage or heritage. To me, when I see that, and when you're talking about these institutions, that somehow, that especially, I mean, the Indian Act and the government's use of the Indian Act, and then turn that around and say also Métis is a provincial thing. So you can see how they're dividing things up already. This seems such to be such a tool of division that's being used institutionally to pit Indigenous person against Indigenous person. And I'm just trying to think, what are your feelings on it? Am I sort of on the right track or not?
Well, you know, I it is a complicated issue. And I think the hard part is that on one level, that we have to respect every Indigenous nation's right to determine who its citizens are.
Right.
And so that's part of it. But having said that, I also very much believe that our ancestors were much more generous and that we brought people into our communities, people married in, they lived among us, and that being Dakota, for example, I think at one time was really much more about our actions. Mm-hmm. It was about how we lived our lives. It was about the way we maintained our kinship relationships, our obligations. It was about the language we spoke, the way that we prayed, who we prayed to, the place where we lived, the foods that we ate, the ceremonies we participated in, all of those things that mm-hmm. distinguished us as Dakota people. And it's not to say that blood wasn't a part of it, but I also know that it couldn't have always been about blood, because we had people who intermarried all the time. Mm-hmm. And if they came in from another nation, for example, they might not be Dakota by blood, but they would certainly be Dakota in terms of their participation in the community. And there would be no question that their children would be part of our communities as well. So I think that, you know, part of my frustration right now is that I agree that these were the blood quantum in the United States, I know, has been an extraordinarily divisive issue.
Yeah.
And that it was imposed in the context of colonialism, that we didn't have blood quantum prior to colonization. And now we've adopted those colonial institutions within our own communities. And it can be absolutely devastating to populations. So my hope is that as indigenous populations or indigenous communities or indigenous nations, that we'll begin to kind of take inventory of how we've been impacted by colonization and start to make some different decisions. But for me as an outsider, I couldn't go into any other indigenous nation and tell them that their way of determining who their members are is wrong.
Right.
So I have to respect that, but hope that as we develop our own critical consciousness among our populations, that things will change, or that those notions will be abandoned.
Right. It is a sense that one of the things that I've done some reading and it just in the way that my wife's side of the family works and how important family is to them. Like, she's very very family oriented. So I can see how that makes it. And then when you talk about all the part of the children and things like that, how that makes a big difference. And then when I was taking Cree lessons as well, there was the guy who was teaching was also a nurse, and he said that family was such a big part. And one of the biggest things you had to learn was to teach the non-Indigenous people is that you had to allow for all the family to come to see somebody in the hospital, because the whole family would come, and there would be, 20, 30 people in a room almost. And so that whole concept seems to be really quite there, but it's still, to me, it's quite interesting, because it's something that the colonialists or the invaders or whatever you want to call them, that this whole culture, the dominant culture, is completely lost. I mean, it's such a shattered group of people that don't have that intimacy or don't have that connection with each other.
Right. And for many indigenous families, I think it's, I think for many of us that our families have been scattered or mm-hmm. harmed or affected so deeply by colonization that we don't function in a good way that we should anymore. So I'm glad to hear that your wife's family still maintains that, because I think it is so important. But I know that many families have been torn apart and have never, but have not yet been able to make that reconnection in a powerful way, so that they can be nurtured and sustained and supported by an extended family.
Yeah, and you can see the difficulties with it, because my wife's family, on her mother's side, really the rock was the grandmother, and after she passed it, there. It's gone through some shaky times, and then all those other influences that you're talking about come into play.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's quite common, actually, and you realize the strength of the women, mm-hmm. the matriarchs, in holding things together.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Now, I got some questions about explaining to non-Indigenous people why and how they benefit from stolen land. And I was giving a talk, and the reason why I brought this came immediately to mind, because I was giving a talk on, I think it was Monday night, and I was talking about sustainability and also talking about Derek's work and things like that. And I talked about how non-Indigenous people are really benefiting for being on stolen land. And one guy says in the back, well, we were colonized first. And first thing came to my mind was, well, yeah, well, we didn't learn anything from that. And,
I like that answer.
You know, it's like we just continued on. But then also, too, the same thing that sort of came to my mind and reminded me, it's such a, of the oppressor's response to make themselves the victim.
Right.
Well, you know, what happened to us? And how do I make that a better question? And the other one is a woman said, actually sent me an email later, and she said, but the land doesn't belong to anybody. And I didn't want to get into the whole discussion about, well, because I did talk about the fact that, you know, all the living beings are sentient, so really the land does belong to quite a few people, if you will. what I did say is that the land is such an important part of Indigenous culture, and that it's so much so that really the two are not separable. And it's something that I don't think that non-Indigenous people really understand that well. And I'm wondering if you want to try to explain more why land is and the land is so important to Indigenous peoples.
Right. You know, well, there are a couple of things, and I think for me the best way to answer this question is to really look at the context of Dakota homeland, which is Minnesota Mokoche, and in English we would translate that as land where the waters reflect the skies, and it's a statement about the enormous number of lakes and rivers and streams that run through Minnesota. And, you know, for us, we, according to our stories, we were created here actually from the earth. And so, like all of the other plants and animals in this area, we are indigenous to this area, that this is the land that the Creator placed us upon. And so everything about our way of life, everything about our language is geographically centered in this place. The food that we eat, our understanding of the environment, all of it makes sense in this particular place. Our sacred sites, the kind of relationship that you develop with a place after coexisting for thousands of years, I mean, that's a really deep, profound connection. And what I tell people when I speak to them about Minnesota and Dakota relationship to the land is I say that there is not another human population on the face of the planet that has the same connection to this land base as our people. The first human language ever spoken here was Dakota. And so everything about our way of being makes sense in this place. If you remove us from the land, which is precisely what was done, that the kind of disconnection that we feel is so extreme, and we can still feel, you know, the land calling us home because we're one of the children of the land. So I would say that, you know, it's true that we didn't own the land per se, but we have a very clear understanding that this is the land that we were supposed to live upon. This is where our people were placed. When it comes to the issue about how people benefit from being on stolen land, I think just a useful, what has worked for me anyway, is to talk about the process of colonization. Because, in the context of Dakota homeland, that white invaders were so desperate to get a hold of our land and resources, they were willing to perpetrate the most horrendous crimes, most heinous crimes in world history to access it, right? And to remove our population so that we would no longer be a threat, so that they could enjoy living within our homeland without any threat from us. And so they terrorized us. I mean, the whole idea of you know, sending punitive expeditions into Dakota territory to hunt down the people who fled to destroy our food sources, to place bounties on our scalps, was all about creating such fear, such terror in our population that we would never dream of returning home to our homeland. And so everyone who exists, occupies Dakota homeland today in Minnesota, does so because they can live without worrying about a Dakota person with a gun or with a bow or with a hatchet showing up on their doorstep threatening their lives for taking our land, because the United States government and Minnesota citizens did such an efficient job of taking care of us before. So the ongoing subjugation of our people allows people, white people predominantly here in Minnesota, to live here without fear. And the hope, of course, in when any colonizers come in and take over someone else's lands and resources, is that the population, the dispossessed people, will eventually forget about what happened, or they'll completely lose their will to fight back. I mean, that's the colonizer's dream, right?
Right.
So as long as our people are willing to fight or are willing to remember that what happened so that people could steal our lands, occupy our homeland, while our people still live in exile, we will continue to be that threat. And, you know, when people bring up the examples of Europe or being coming from other populations who were colonized, you know, every group of people has to make their own determination about when they are going to abandon the fight.
Right.
And indigenous peoples here have not abandoned the fight. We remember, and we will continue to resist, because we know how important our relationship to our homeland is.
I mean, that's a very good point, because so often I think, too, people don't realize the violence that occurred to have the land that they have, and
right,
that they're getting from, their sustenance and their life from. And I think that's so forgotten as well, especially quite willfully amongst the colonizers.
Right. Well, and one of the things that I talk about in the Minnesota context, too, is that there hasn't been a single generation of white Minnesotans who's wanted to make things right, that they all want to benefit from what was gained as a consequence of genocide, ethnic cleansing, and land theft, but they don't want to take any accountability or make amends for those crimes. And so, you know, that's a statement about, a very clear statement that these are not just historic harms, but they're ongoing.
Exactly, yeah. Works actually well going into the next piece, because in the pre-reading for Deep Green Resistance is actually a piece of yours called Indigenous Peoples and the Revolution, in which you are speaking to non-Indigenous peoples, and you say, if you want a future in which your children can potentially live peacefully, how you develop your notions of the future society with us is of fundamental importance. So how would you see that peaceful future looking like?
Well, I think we have to go through some difficult times to get there.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, what I would say is that there is a lot that can be done to, I think, trying to rectify some of the harms so that we can move on to a place of peaceful coexistence. But that's a long way down the line. Mm-hmm. I think that first of all, and I said this to a group last week, and you know, when I say it, it seems rather obvious, but I think it still can be shocking to people who are invested in the nation state, for example. So mm-hmm. Someone was asking about being allies, and you know, what does being an ally look like? And I said that, you know, for one, if you understand the harm that the United States government in this case has perpetrated, and the ongoing harms that continue to be perpetrated not only against people all around the world, but also lands all around the world, animals and plants, if you agree that those harms are ongoing and that they're inherent in the structure, then you also have to agree that it needs to be eradicated, right? You can't get all teary-eyed when you see the American flag and and feel, you know, the sense of patriotism welling up, because you just can't imagine the future without the United States of America if you're invested in maintaining that structure, then that means you're invested in maintaining systems and institutions that are inherently oppressive. And that's not acceptable. You can't be an ally and believe in the goodness of those institutions, right?
Right.
So the first part, obviously, I think, is about if people want to demonstrate that they're allies, then they have to be willing to give up what their predecessors have helped to establish or create. And it means the rejection of much of their identity to begin with. And I think that's the biggest kind of psychological hurdle that people have to overcome. And then work to take this down.
Yeah.
You know, for in the Minnesota context, again, and I it's easiest for me to speak in that local context because that's what I think about all the time. What does this mean for Dakota people? You know, in the state of Minnesota, for example, there are almost 12 million acres of land, lands that are held, federal lands, state lands, tax-forfeited lands, Metro Commission lands, that could be returned to Dakota people tomorrow without touching a single acre of privately held land. So if we had almost 12 million acres of land for our Dakota people to return to our homeland to work on our own kind of food security or how we can feed ourselves down the road, if we could work on developing communities where we could revive Dakota ways of being, that would go a long way towards starting to heal those relationships. I can start to believe that there might be some good intentions there, right?
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, needs to happen right away. Otherwise, our populations really are going to be condemned, I think, to death if in the context of collapse. So, you know, we need to have a land base. And what I would say to any allies, even from right now through kind of a post-collapse scenario, is that that people here, everyone always needs to understand on whose land they live.
Yeah.
And who has primacy to that land, who knows how to say the prayers and sing the songs, the ones that help maintain good relations with all of the animal and plant beings, with the land itself in that particular place. And so if that primacy is respected, I think that we can, you know, we can talk, we can work together.
Right. We talked about this a bit already because you continue on in that same sentence as the second, if you want to help us. Second, you can help us by taking down civilization because every blow against the American imperialism is an act of indigenous liberation. And I think you touch on that a lot previously, and that's what I talk about the tar sands, because you brought up another interesting point here where you're talking about food security and having being able to feed yourself, and in Alberta here this seems to be becoming a really huge issue, and the tar sands is classic because not only is it taking the land away, but it's poisoning all the land around it. So it's, you know, so you have people dying of cancers that are extremely abnormal for the population size that they're in. And you have a large number of people dying of cancers. And you have the point where scientists are saying, yes, the moose meat is poisonous or is toxic. The fish are toxic. And these are all traditional foods as well. It just, that's when we were talking about the urgencies. This brings home that things really need to stop yesterday.
Right. I mean, it's absolutely heartbreaking, and I think it also reveals the desperation of this destructive society to kind of grasp the last bit of whatever they possibly can, and it's almost like getting as much destruction as they can so that someone can make the last dollar before everything is destroyed.
Yeah, yeah.
It's outrageous.
And I kind of worry the same kind of thing will happen in North Dakota as well, because they have the gas shale or oil shale there.
Yeah, I've been talking to some people about that too, and that's my fear is that, well, I have no doubt that the United States government will claim whatever it needs to as the pinch grows tighter and tighter, I think. Oil supplies dwindle more and more, that indigenous populations there are going to be pushed out of the way.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is a time in which, you know, you'll find out truly who your allies are.
That's for sure.
Because it seems to be, I mean, again, in Canada, for sure, that's where we're seeing, because of tar sands in the western area, we're going to see, you know, potential pipelines going. I mean, because China is now involved, and that scares the crap out of me on a number of different levels. A friend of mine works for Amnesty International, and he was showing me pictures of sites, villages that were shot up by gunboats in Chad, where these were mercenaries basically hired by the Chinese government to push people off the land so they could bring oil companies in.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's that level. Then there's the level of, you're going to be involved in tar sands, that means they need to get the stuff out to the West Coast, so that means pipelines and then tanker traffic on the West Coast. So that's, which hasn't been allowed. BC for a long time has maintained that tanker traffic has to be outside the 200-mile limit, and this may be the thin edge of the wedge to allow it in, and then we'll see a lot of that. Well, then we'll see the tanker traffic quite close to the BC coast.
Yeah, it is only going to get more and more ugly, and I think that we have to, and again, that's the urgency that we, yeah, I think that we're both feeling right now, and the hope is that, when you talked about finding out who our allies are, is that the uglier it gets, or the more people feel the crisis, or it comes home to them, mm-hmm, that they'll be mobilized, or that they'll be compelled to take action and to take a stand, to take a side. Fortunately, I think it's going to have to become very, very personal for people before they commit to taking action.
Yeah. Well, lots to think about. Now for your random Derek Jensen question. Number 7 is, did school address the questions most important to your own life? If so, what were the questions? If not, how do you wish school had been different so that it could have addressed your questions? What were the questions you wish school had addressed?
Well, I think education for me was, in many ways, a very violent process. And I always did very well in school, that I learned pretty quickly how to maneuver successfully within that environment. But there were times when it was really, really just offensive and an assault on humanity. And I think I've been more aware of it now, too, watching my own children going through the educational system and realizing how much of it is absolutely irrelevant, mm-hmm, to the big or the important issues that they're going to face in their lives, and in terms of conveying the values that I would want conveyed, you know, to my children, or the kind of values that we try to promote within our family or community. So, and interestingly, I'm working on right now the second volume to the Decolonization Handbook, and Dr. Gregory Cajete has an essay in this collection on education, and he really does a fine job of comparing Indigenous education to American education, and talking about, you know, why the American education system has failed everyone, not just Indigenous students. But really at the core of it was, I think, Indigenous education being centered in life, centered in how to live in this world in a meaningful way. And much of, obviously, that's not the focus in the mainstream educational system.
Right.
So, you know, my hope is that eventually, well, this education system will be one of those institutions that comes down.
Right.
And that we can begin to really rethink the way that we raise our children and the life lessons that we can help them learn in a, I guess, non-oppressive environment, and one that really focuses on interacting with the rest of the world respectfully.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you contacting me.
Thank you very much, and have a good night.
Good night.
No. Throw your towel on the floor, let down your hair. There's something going on tonight, something right here. So turn down the lights, lock all the doors. We're taking the weight of the world off your shoulders. We'll take all the weight of the world off our shoulders. Throw your towel on the floor, let down your hair. They can run around it all, we're right here. So turn down the lights, we'll lock all the doors. Take all the weight of the world off your shoulders. We'll take all the weight of the world off our shoulders. Throw your towel on the floor, let down your hair. There's something here as old as time, I can feel it in the air. So turn down the lights, we'll lock all the doors. 'Cause I know tonight, we need this more than ever. I know tonight we need this more than ever. We're taking the weight. We're taking the weight. We're taking the weight of the world off our shoulders. We'll take all the weight of the world off our shoulders.
And that was Filthy Politicians with We're Right Here. I really appreciated this interview with Wazia Tawi. I was in tears listening to her recount the heinous crimes against humanity committed against her people. And there are three major things that I take away from this discussion. One is, no matter how you coach it, colonialism is violent and a crime against humanity. Two, that the colonized need to take on and stop the systems and institutions of colonization. This goes for both indigenous and non-indigenous peoples. And three is the urgency that both of us feel and understand that the systems that are destroying the planet have to come down now. All of this above makes, to me, the tar sands a crime against humanity and the natural world. Taking us out is Mary Goodell with Strength from her album Bombazine. Thank you for listening, and remember, the resistance needs you. Needs you. Needs you.
We both know that it's wrong, but the news makes one of us helpless and one of us bold. We've had our ears to the floor for years. I know the signs of fright. One of us fills with regret, the other will fight. I would if I could look into her eyes and show exactly where I'm getting it from. The marks I've made like wounds are my successes on the earth. I turn and she turns with me. I love, but you won't hear me. How can that be? She says, you amaze me. How did you get so strong? As a fire.